Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I would like to continue this evolution of protected cultivation, mentioning the form that does not directly use solar radiation. That's in Chris's evolutionary scheme is kind of the last one with the spaceman. And interestingly, NASA plays a very big part in where we are at today. Jules calls this indoor horticulture. More frequently, we hear the term indoor agriculture, and one form under that umbrella is vertical farming. So we've been at this for about 12,000 years, starting with open field agriculture. And then for less than 2,000 of those years, into actual serious greenhouse production. That's GHA, in the high tunnel HTA. And today, within the last 50 years, we've evolved to the CEA era, controlled environment agriculture, and that has various manifestations. And then that's been about over the last 50 years, and still coming, probably less than a decade away now, we're still in the experimental phase, will be ETA, extraterrestrial agriculture, and that will go through various phases of evolution as well. So some of the characteristics, so that we're all on the same page about what indoor ag vertical farming is, it typically occurs within an opaque structure, a high bay building or a high bay room within a building. And the further away from the equator you are in either direction, the better it is if that structure is insulated. Sole source lighting of some kind is therefore important since we're not using solar. And building HVAC, heating, ventilating, air conditioning, becomes very important when you fill large warehouses with a lot of vegetation. It can pull down ambient carbon dioxide. It can humidify the atmosphere beyond what you want. So HVAC becomes very important. And it's also very challenging today with respect to warehouses that were not built originally with CEA or indoor ag in mind. So CO2 control becomes important. And of course, soil is culture. Typically recirculating hydroponics, aeroponics are used today. And without question, computerization and automation of the process. So indoor ag vertical farming was born in the USA. And we think that the first one actually started out as a research project of the very innovative General Electric Company, which you've already heard from Krishna, in Syracuse, New York. They started developing vegetable kitchen gardens for nuclear submarines that were going to be submerged for 6 months to a year, and they wanted to bring fresh vegetables to the sailors. So back in 1973, GE got some Department of Defense funding for that, and they began to do that. But unfortunately, as with many large companies in this country, they cannot keep their interest up if it's not showing a profit line, a near-term return on investment. So GE, not the innovative scientists, but the administrators, decided to drop that. And so for a few years, it went through changes of sponsors, changes of owners, actually. And at some point in this period, it became commercial, And what we have been able to read from newspaper clippings and so on, they talk about being able to command rather high prices, premium prices for their tomato products. And, you know, Genoponics was one of a kind. It put together hydroponics. It put together CO2 control for that time, air conditioning. And they were even using high-pressure sodium lamps. So they had to have some separation of distance there. It ended up finally shutting down in 1984. Cherry Kubota and I are looking into trying to find more about the history of Genoponics. We're contacting people and so on as we try to write this early history of indoor ag. I think it's very important that we try to do that. Have you learned anything more, Cherry? Not since we spoke. Okay. Well, the one I'm more comfortable with, because I visited several times during its run, is Phyto Farms of America, located about 2 hours west of Chicago on the tollway. And it was developed actually in 1978 by General Mills, another large progressive company at the time. And it was on two layers, so I suppose technically it could be considered the first vertical farm, unless Genoponics was. We don't know yet. We're still looking into that. So they had some innovations. They patented water-cooled HID lamps that they were using, and they had self-spacing crops. I'll show you some pictures of that. And they negotiated with Commonwealth Edison for off-peak power rates that kept them going. And so then, of course, General Mills, the big company that they are, they lost interest. But then the original developer, Noel Davis, bought it back from them and made an actual commercial enterprise out of it in 1983. And it closed in the early 1990s for a variety of reasons, including some frustration about the need to expand and the inability to do so. So, hardiness zone 5A is where DeKalb is, and it gets pretty cold, and Phyto Farms claimed they never had to turn on their heat in the warehouse in the winter because of the heat being put out by the HID lamps. And that large cylinder in front of the building is anhydrous CO2, which when expanded becomes a gas, and then they would inject that into the building because it was drawing down CO2 so fast where they were growing. And then they would have trucks pull up outside the building, and then they would ship daily to the Chicago and Milwaukee markets. And they had good markets, they had restaurants, they had stores, they had chefs who loved it because it was sand-free, the produce, which was very frustrating to them when they would get it from the field. And so here on these two layers, what they would do is germinate the seeds in germination chambers on the far end of the building and then put that into aluminum crossbars that they would mount on a self-spacing conveyor system. And then that would move toward the near end of this picture where they would do the harvesting, the washing, the packing, and the shipping. And you can see here the 1,000-watt metal halide and high-pressure sodium lamps that they had jackets made so that the cooling water would go through that, and then they could put these lamps 4 feet above the crop without scorching it. A non-water-cooled lamp, you never could do that at 1,000-watt HPS or MH. And then they have these augers, these screws that would turn, and they would space out the crop every day a little bit just to keep pace with the growth curve so that they weren't wasting photons between the crops. And they didn't really look like this with spaces between. I took this picture myself when I was there, and with the spinach coming at me, although much slower, and I was at the near end, and they were planting at the far end. So they would have a regular gradient of crops, and then multiple benches across the one level, and then a duplicate of that on the bottom. So 1978 to early 1900s. Definitely one of the first commercial IAs, and maybe technically a VF. Okay. In Japan, in the 1970s, Toyoki Kozai was training in research, and then he rose to prominence at Chiba University and really led the charge to develop the Japanese plant factory concept. And then the first commercial plant factory in Japan began in 1983. High-pressure sodium lamps were used. I don't believe they were water-cooled, but they might have been lower wattage. They were actually used by the mid-1990s, but then in the late 1990s, they actually switched over to fluorescent lamps, much shorter lifespan. But, of course, plants grow beautifully under fluorescent lamps, and so they did that for a while. And then by the mid-2000s, they began converting over to light-emitting diodes. Kozai also sort of espoused this concept of the vertical stacking, the multi-tiers of plants, so that you could multiply the footprint floor area by how many ever layers of crops that you were growing. And so this is kind of where the term vertical farming comes in. Japan is kind of unique in that there is some evidence of government subsidy to commercial and academia, and there is an involvement of academic in along with industry. And so you have a diverse industry there with all kinds of sizes of businesses. So the first edition of the book, edited by Kozai, Plant Factory, came out in 2014. And he did that, edited that in collaboration with Genhua Nu from Texas. And then this year, they are working on a second edition, right? Coming out sometime this year. Yeah. And then also, in collaboration with Eric Runkel and others at Michigan State, Kozai is coming, has already come out with a book on LED lighting for urban ag. So Kozai himself is a book factory. It's really documenting all of these accomplishments, and we really appreciate that. So every place in the world is interested in this now. So it may have started in this country, but it's spread everywhere, and you know, U.S. and Japan mainly. But here in this country, it's mostly industry, private industry driven with investors. Economies of scale are very big. We have 56, 57 and counting. More coming in, more new starts than those going out, but there are a few that are not making it. There are a greater number of sizes in Japan, from very small rooms to large buildings. Genhua is that number about 200, fairly reasonably accurate right now for the number of PFALs in Japan. That's what I was able to get so far, but I'm not sure. That changes daily. And then Taiwan, Korea, and China are all coming on, and particularly strong in developing and exporting technology and kind of watching things. The UK, the EU, Canada, yeah, a lot of interest, but There, I feel that the commitment and the involvement in the greenhouse industry may actually be holding back some of the expansion there, because there's such a commitment to that area of CEA, which is more semi-controlled environment. But there are indoor farms in all of those places. Right now, I sense that the expansion is greatest in Asia. Now I'd like to mention NASA's involvement in this. They've been very instrumental since the beginning. Because of the need to support human beings in space and to provide food and air revitalization, they got into this research very early. So back in the mid-1980s, they got a high-altitude simulation chamber from the Mercury mission, and they converted it into a closed growth chamber. And that went operational in 1987, and it lasted and was used as a research tool until 2000. And then NASA, it dismantles everything. Rather than leave it for a museum, they cut it apart and throw it away. So that's what they did. But BPC, as we call it, was very over-engineered in terms of thermal control and also in terms of preparation for recirculating hydroponics that they used inside. And then they even had like a mission control room that for controlling every aspect. And this really was making a contribution to the controlled environment industry and with their consultation with the growth chamber companies and so on. And here's a view from inside on the first floor there, Neil Yorio and another person growing Waldman's green leaf lettuce on one of the tiers, hydroponics, of course, and here Bill Knott and Tom Dreschel growing dwarf wheat, and that's high pressure sodium lighting overhead. They took a lot of photosynthetic data in a closed system by measuring drawdown of CO2, and here's a view looking up, seeing wheat growing on four levels. Well, now that the BPC has been hacked apart and thrown away, NASA now realizes that back in the 1980s and 90s, they had they called this their vertical farm. And they do that very nostalgically. So it doesn't exist anymore. But at the same time, NASA was also ramping up in the sole source lighting area, and they were using light emitting diodes. They were sponsoring work at Wisconsin, both at the university and in a private company, developing this technology. And then in 1992, 1 year before Nakamura's discovery of the blue LED, they actually published a paper growing seedlings under red LEDs and small blue fluorescent lamps. And then as soon as the blue LEDs came up in efficiency, then they did red and blue. And then later they brought in green and discovered how important, as a waveband of PAR, green is, especially when you have tight, closed canopies. Well, also with NASA funding at that time, at Purdue, we were working on the lightsicle concept. We did it first with compact fluorescent lamps, but then we thought, gee, with active heat sinking, we ought to be able to grow plants where they just grow up between aerated LED strips. So we got that concept, and then by 2003, then, we had the first versions of the light sickles. This is with other NASA funding again, Gioia Massa doing the work, and Orbitech helping us develop the f- first-generation light sickles, which were only 2 feet long, but you could turn the lights on incrementally and save a lot of energy that way. So then about that same time, with most of the people doing early plant LED work funded by NASA, at one of these ASHS meetings, we convened a workshop on LEDs in horticulture. And it was published the next year in 2008 in Hort Science, and that is one of the most highly read issues of Hort Science. And our article in that issue, led by Joya Massa, is one of the most highly and frequently cited articles in Hort Science. So about the same time then, Dixon Despommier, a professor of microbiology and health science at Columbia University, he and his undergraduate class discovered vertical farming. But I've got to give Dixon credit, because all this time, the plant scientists working on LEDs, the public never knew anything about this. Other scientists knew about it, but it was not in popular knowledge. So when he came out with this book, The Vertical Farm, in 2010, his contribution was raising awareness of vertical farming and the technologies that could go into it to the public. He did not cite the papers that I've mentioned already, any of them in this report, and they may not have ever known about it, but the fact that coming at this from a different discipline, you can come up with the same concept, I think is very interesting, and it's significant. The downtown Manhattan versions with cattle and chickens and corn and wheat crops may not have been very realistic in terms of logistics, in terms of energy and where the energy would come from, but and it has created some trouble for those of us who are trying to do serious work to enable the vertical farming industry, especially among peer reviewers who think this is either a boutique industry or is totally out to lunch. But we have a worldwide industry gaining a foothold now. So to wrap up here quickly, then in 2014, NASA launched the Veggie on the International Space Station, where they're growing leafy green crops for both research and for pick-and-eat scenarios of the astronauts. That's going on even now. And then in 2014, same time, we published the article. This is the second most highly cited article in the LSSR journal on the combination of close canopy and targeted LED lighting, saving a lot of energy throughout the growth cycle over the course, about 50% so far. We can do better than that. And then, finishing up a NEPA-sponsored SCRI project, back then in 2015, Jules Janik twisted our arms to publish a comprehensive review article in Horticultural Reviews. So Jules rattled our cage. He got us to write it up. And so we have this this work in volume 43 of Hort Reviews. So here's where the IAVF energy, the IAVF industry is today. It has to have all of these components that are on the stage, on the slide here. Hydroponics has been around since 1929, but it really came into being during World War II in the South Pacific. Plastics then in the 1930s and 40s. Obvious advantages of combining plastic and hydroponics. The Earhart Phytotron, the North Carolina Phytotrons, the Wisconsin Biotron, and all the controlled environment research around the world in the 40s and 50s and 60s led to growth chambers developing these environmental control systems that are still being improved today. And then the increased computerization and automation continuing from the 80s to the present. But the technology development that's put it all over the top is this development of LED lighting and being able to get away from the energy-consuming high-pressure sodium lamps. So here's where we are today. A lot of this follows the technology developments for LEDs. They continue to advance in efficacy of energy utilization. Ongoing developments in leveraging the unique properties of LEDs, things like we do, to further reduce the energy consumption. The decreases in capital costs of manufacturing LEDs, that's starting to have an impact. And a word of caution there, some imports of cheap white LEDs, people buy them up, they love them, but they don't necessarily last that long. So there is that. And then we have this trend of a few very large VFs in this country. Right now they are getting huge grants, $50, $100, $200 million. I don't know if the industry can tolerate that just based upon grants, because some of it has to occur on its own merit. And then coming down the road, the plant pharmaceutical industry, including cannabis and other things, expanding markets. So there's all of this going on. And then we see this trend of going from combining monochromatic colors of LEDs to either whites with a few reds or just warm white LEDs. And I believe cost is driving these trends. So here I leave you with the current major challenges for the industry. They're still the same as they were. Capital investment to get going, the need for premium pricing for profitability and economic viability, keeping your venture capital investors satisfied, availability, there's workforce issues, and then expansion, market share, competition, all of that and more. And with that, thank you.
Thank you.